The Light of Amsterdam opens in Belfast on the day of George Best's funeral, when the whole city became awake. And it tells the story of three couples, a mother going on her daughter's hen party, a father lumbered with his 16-year-old son, and a husband and wife, all heading for Amsterdam for a weekend just before Christmas. The part of the book I'm going to read is from the end of the first chapter, and it describes one of the central characters, Alan, who's recently divorced, has been summoned by his ex-wife to the family home to desperately try and communicate with their 16-year-old son, who has entered the dark waters of teenage angst. It hasn't been a very wonderful day. But on this funeral day, as he drove slowly and reluctantly back to his flat, he sensed only the infinite complexity of what stretched ahead of him. He thought about the soup, knew how much he wanted to stay, even in a house where he wasn't fully loved. He thought of stolen blessings and the mess of pottage that awaited him. And irrespective of what he had brought on himself, couldn't help but feel cheated out of things that were rightfully his. He drove past council workers removing barriers and traffic cones, their yellow jackets luminous against the day's shadows. Windblown flower petals frittered up like confetti. George was starting out on his journey by now. He felt shut out too by his own son. If he would let him be his father, there were so many important things that he could tell him. Things that might help him face full on the relentless storm of life. As he drove, he talked to his son, told him that nothing was simple, except to the stupid and the dangerous. So Jack, don't be frightened of uncertainty and confusion. It's our natural state. And as he headed along the embankment beside the dark skin of the river, suddenly there was a single rower sculling the water, his oars twisting little curlicues of white. He pulled the car over to the pavement, got out, and stood watching as the oarsman slowly disappeared into the dusk. He was taking George home. After all the public pomp and show of ceremony, the eulogies and the flowers, he was taking George home. If he were religious, he would have said a prayer for safe crossing, a prayer for all their coming journeys. But instead, he simply bowed his head for a moment, then watched as the silent wake slowly disappeared and the street lamps began to sheen and smear the dark surface of the water into some new tremble of light.
It's a beautifully written novel, David. I don't mean to be condescending when I say that, but it's all the richer for hearing your voice. It's also, in narrative terms, quite a complicated novel. I wonder if you could possibly just describe its outline, blurb it a bit for the prospective reader.
I basically try to internalise the life of the three central characters. They're quite contrasting characters, and they face quite different predicaments in their personal lives, and they've all come to Amsterdam for different reasons. So I'm really trying to capture the inner life of each of these three central characters. Alan, going to see his great hero Bob Dylan in concert, but lumbered with this 16-year-old son of his who doesn't want to be in Amsterdam. Karen, who is reluctantly tagging on to her daughter's hen party. And Marion, middle-aged, insecure, nervous, who's come with her husband and is afflicted by her own doubts. And I try to interweave those three internalizations.
It's a very accidental connection between them, though, isn't it? I mean, is that how you see life?
Yes, I would say so. I think also because the book was largely written while I was working as a teacher, it always helped me to write in achievable sections. So the idea of just writing a novel with a vague, endless horizon was very daunting. So I liked the idea of writing this section and then just adding on the next section and then adding on the third section.
This is a question which I fear you'll have been expecting, because in fact all the reviewers have brought it up. It's been very well received, your novel, quite properly. But they do say you've rather shifted your ground.
I have. you should never think about what posterity is going to say about you. But as I get older, I have this nagging little voice in the back of my head that I don't want to be labelled the writer of the troubles. And basically, I got my instructions from my wife, who told me to lighten up, and it was time I wrote a book about love. And this is my attempt to write a book about love.
There's a certain kind of sort of depressive climate in the book, though, isn't there? I mean, it's almost like sort of, it's almost like an escape from something which is all these characters.
True love never runs smoothly, and this is the closest I'm ever going to get to writing a book that is even vaguely happy. So love is complex. Love can be painful. Love can be demanding, especially, and I think it's one of the book's central themes, the love of a parent for a child. And I think anyone who's ever had an adolescent will know that sometimes love can be stretched very, very tight.
Jack, in fact, is one of the more interesting. This is the son, the son who's gone goth, in fact.
Yes. I mean,
it is difficult, and I'm not sure Bob Dylan is really.
No.
Would you like to say something about that? The relationship of father to sons in this?
Jack has done what all normal teenagers do. He's gone into this tunnel of teenage darkness. Thankfully, teenagers go in and come out. But that period when they're inside that self-absorption, that monosyllabic, closed-down world, which feels as if it's linked primarily to a computer as opposed to a parent, it's a difficult and painful rite of passage for the parent. You know, all the old simplicities are gone. And I wanted to bring out the father's love for Jack. And what the father is ultimately struggling to do is to find a way of expressing that love that won't suffocate his child, that won't embarrass his child, won't be irrelevant to his child. And it's very, very challenging how you find a way to give your love to a child sometimes.
It's also very challenging to write about it. I mean, I think it's fair to say that the quality of your writing is poetic. It's beautifully so. Does that, in fact, get in the way of actually being kind of emotionally honest sometimes? You know, when in fact, as I said, you've got to strip away the poetry and actually get to the heart of the matter.
It's a difficult question. Although the book is very different in its subject matter to previous work, I think really the style is probably reasonably similar. I started off in life trying to write poetry, and there's some legacy of that lingers on, for good or bad, I'm not quite sure.
People tend to place you in the tradition of Brian Moore, don't they? Which I don't know whether you accept that as a legacy.
I could only say in a genuinely humble way, I mean, that's a very strong compliment, and I personally wouldn't ever make that claim about myself.
But of course he left, didn't he?
He did. I heard him read not a huge amount of time before he died, and bizarrely he said it was one of the few times he'd ever been asked to read in Belfast, and the venue was absolutely packed to the gills.
Did he have an American accent? I spoke to him a couple of times on the West Coast, and he seemed to have a sort of kind of compromised way of speaking.
I think probably so. Some people might or might not think the name from Brian de Brian was an affectation. I don't know, but what does it really matter at the end of the day? He wrote beautiful books.
What I would say is that, you know, with reference to your book, you voice your books very carefully, don't you?
I try to. I mean, the key to writing the inner self is capturing the voice, and the key also is to be able to see the world through the eyes of that person, to empathetically become that person, so that you're not remote, you're not a judge, you're not standing in judgment on them, but you're seeing the world through their eyes, for better or worse.
Just to change the subject a bit, your publishers have given you a very beautiful cover, but they've actually decided that the subject of the book is Amsterdam. Now, I get to ask you an obvious question, why is that? But I don't remember an Irvine Welsh in his novel, actually, sort of, the hero at the end is going to Amsterdam with a one-way ticket. Why did you choose that place, apart from the Bob Dylan connection?
Well, the facetious answer, we'll start with that, would be that you hope desperately that all those readers out there will think they will get some kind of salacious thrill from reading the book set in Amsterdam and rush out and buy it. But if anyone feels they're going to get that kind of stereotypical Amsterdam, they'll be so disappointed. They'll probably ask for their money back. I first went to Amsterdam when I was 19. The Troubles had basically just started. I went in the summer to Amsterdam. It was my first stay in a European city. And I was just completely amazed by the city. The beauty of the architecture, the painting, the number of young people. It just seemed the most wonderful place. And I could hear this voice in my head saying, everybody who lives in Northern Ireland, it should be compulsory if they go and live in Amsterdam for 6 months and the politicians for at least a year.
But in the novel, it's much more temporary, isn't it? It's a kind of day pass, practically.
It is. It's a bit of a cliche, but I think it's true that sometimes when we leave our normal environment and journey somewhere far, it allows us to see our own lives more clearly in sharper focus. And I like the idea of being in Amsterdam and having the city be disorientating, be surprising, and also be powerful, and how that would impact and affect the emotions and the thinking of the central characters.
When I was reading your novel, which I was profoundly moved by, there was something you said earlier which struck me as well, and that is that I went to Amsterdam too when I was a young man, and I was struck by the fact that it was somehow supranational. You'd go into a bookshop and there'd be as many French books as English books as German books as Dutch books, often at the back. And it seemed to me, it's not Dutch. I mean, Amsterdam, in fact, had very separate, and it's almost like an escape from nationality. Is that a theme in your book?
I think so. And, you know, there's so many stereotypes about Amsterdam, but in some ways Amsterdam is a reasonably conservative city, quite a traditional conservative city. And obviously it's marked by significant amounts of tolerance. And I just liked that combination. The other thing that was important to me about Amsterdam was I had come from an environment where history was divisive. You know, history was raw and bitter. But in Amsterdam, history works itself out in the aesthetics of the architecture. It's an ever-present aesthetic. And it seemed to me to be a beautiful thing.
It's that Simon Sharma point about the embarrassment of riches, isn't it? You get a sense of terrific richness in the place, which, you know, yes. I don't always feel when I'm in London. I'm certainly don't feel in Northern Ireland always. It's interesting. I'm going to ask you, again, a very obvious question. What does George Best mean to you?
I was lucky enough to see George Best. I was about 13 or 14 years of age. He was playing for Northern Ireland at Windsor Park against Scotland. I had no ticket. I had no money other than the bus fare. And I got a bus into town and walked to Windsor Park. And those were the days before soccer, football was corporate. So I just picked someone with a friendly face and said, "Mister, lift me over." And he lifted me over the turnstile. So for the price of a bus fare, I saw George Best in his prime play against Scotland, and he just moved in a different element. The memory has always stayed with me. And, you know, there were so many different moments, but the one that I cling to, there was always some poor soul whose job it was to kick George. You know, it was the hard man in the other team. And George just welcomed that, and he was like a matador. And at some point during the game, he put his foot on the ball, and he just invited this hard man to come and get it, and they never did. They just were so frightened of the inevitable humiliation, they never did. But the memory of that particular game is burns bright in my memory. A sad and tragic life, but I just try to remember him through the eyes of that child and what he was like on a pitch.
You start very powerfully with George Best in the novel and finish with Bob Dylan. What does he mean to you?
Bob Dylan was one of my teenage heroes, and when I was 16, I grew up in a very strong evangelical context. But when I was about 16, my parents bought me a little red mono record player. I think in later years they came to think of it as the Trojan horse. But I didn't have a record, so I went into Belfast and I bought my first LP. And I didn't know a huge amount about Bob Dylan, but I bought Bob Dylan's greatest hits. And when I played one particular track, which was Like a Rolling Stone, and those opening, freewheeling, cascading chords, my whole world just turned on its axis. Nothing ever seemed quite the same again. It just freed a whole range of different possibilities that I hadn't realised even existed in life. So for me, that moment was a real primary experience, and that's why Bob Dylan features in the book, I think.
It's a kind of quest for Dylan, in a sense, isn't it? I mean, you could actually see it that way.
But it's also connected with that inevitability, too, of your heroes disappointing you.
Yeah.
And the experience of Dylan in concert for Alan is ultimately a disappointing one. He's come 15 years too late.
Why didn't you actually write the whole novel about Alan? This must have occurred to you as a possibility at one point, or did it? I don't know.
I think I probably did consider it, but I just wanted the greater variety. I just wanted different types of relationship. I didn't just want to have a novel that focused on father-child. I wanted different perspectives on family life.
It's a very sad little crisis that he made for himself, isn't it? I mean, a good marriage counsellor could have mended it very easily, I think.
Yes. And
perhaps you'd better describe it, actually.
Well, he has committed this crazy, foolish, deeply regretted act of infidelity. And he has found himself paying a very, very high price for it. And his whole life, a life that seemed, solid, secure, is suddenly thrown out of kilter. And he feels windblown, rootless. And I suppose going to Amsterdam and to see Bob Dylan is his attempt to refine something that he feels is lost. And I also remember, on a personal note, that as that 14-year-old boy, I actually got George Best's autograph. And my abiding regret is that I have lost it. I don't know how, but I have lost it. And I'm in deep penance for that crime.
David, you I think this is your eighth or ninth novel, is it? Published novel?
Eighth book.
And you've had a very full life otherwise. You've been a very busy sort of professional person otherwise. Why do you write novels? What do you think novels can do that other forms of writing or discourse or human activity can't do?
Well, I tend to subscribe to the philosophy that I tend to I tend to subscribe to the philosophy that without art we perish from life, and writing keeps me alive and keeps me well, and it's something I feel I want to do, and I want to try and do it better and better every time. And it just makes me feel more complete as a human being. And I do feel that the novel continues to be the medium that offers the best prospect of helping us to understand what it is to be human. I think that's the novel's great achievement.
It's a very lofty sort of sense of what fiction is, and I feel that I feel that this novel actually achieves it. I do feel sorry for Alan in a way. Is there any kind of happiness that you foresee for him over the edge of the novel?
I think that his love for his child will ultimately bear fruit, and that his child will return to him. Though sometimes readers ask you about the characters, what happens to them after the end of the novel? And the simple truth is, I have no idea, and that is for the reader to imagine and create. I don't know.
Let's talk about readers, because in fact one of the ideas of the Fiction Uncovered Prize is that it is not just one of these kind of gladiator contest in which a Russell Crowe figure stands on the steaming, bloody corpses of those he's defeated. But in fact, it creates, as it were, a menu, an interesting menu for readers' groups. If in fact you were, you know, part of a readers' group, what kind of questions would you like people to, as it were, explore in discussing your novel, you know, The Light of Amsterdam? Because we should say, in fact, there are two other centres in the novel than Alan.
Yes. It's a very difficult question, and I am not really sure what the answer is. I do know, as a writer, that the greatest mistakes I have made as a writer are when I start to think about the reader. When I start to think, what does the reader need or what does the reader want, that's when it goes wrong. So I have to write the book that is in me. I have to write it through me, and I don't know what I'm talking about now. Sorry.
That's right.
I'm just talking gibberish.
I think you are, actually. I mean,
it's too hard a question. What you want to know what the readers would ask? What I'd like them to ask?
I'll put the question a different way, David. I say, there are two other centres to this book, both of which are sort of focused on women's experience.
Yes.
Was that difficult for you, as it were, to cross the gender line?
I don't think so, and I mean it's an entire. Terrible generalisation to say, but I suspect that the emotional inner life of women is more interesting than that of men, simply because women allow themselves access to a wider range of emotions. It's not that they have a wider range of emotions, but they permit themselves access, I think, to a wider range of emotions. And I find women, as a writer, infinitely interesting, complex, subtle.
And they too, in fact, have little crises in their lives, don't they?
They do.
Which, in fact, the novel pinpoints. Could you say something about that?
The first middle-aged woman, Marion, is terribly insecure about her appearance, about her handsome husband's potential for infidelity.
And the gym membership.
And he's bought her a gym membership, which is a two-edged sword for any woman to get that as a present, I think. And the image I like about the gym is she goes to the gym for the first time and she sees this beautiful young woman who's beautifully toned on a running machine, and it's as if she's running to the image that she sees of herself in the glass, the perfect image that she sees, and she knows, Marion knows, she will never reach that image. So the book plays out on her insecurities and trying to come to terms with those. And the other female character is Karen, who works every hour God sends as a cleaner and in a care home, but is one of those people in life who has not perhaps had all the opportunities that her character deserves, and she struggles. She struggles to pay for her wayward daughter's every whim and all the accoutrements and desires that she has for the wedding.
And I liked her a lot, actually.
I just wanted to bring her to Amsterdam because it opens so many windows for her and she sees things so freshly and with such reality.
What is the light in Amsterdam?
I think that because I grew up in that evangelical background, I mean, I don't have that evangelical faith, but there are images that stay with me. And one of those powerful images would be of transfiguration, or transcendence as well. So what I wanted to do ultimately in this book is take three seemingly mundane, quiet lives, take them to this new place and have them transfigured, both by the power of the city, but also by the power of their insights into their own lives and their own dreams and their hopes for their own futures.
One of the words which came up in all the judges' comments on your novel was poetic, which is not, in fact, universal in fiction. I mean, we tend to have fiction which is very realistic, you know, and sometimes, you know, ultra-realistic. There is, in fact, a poet inside you trying to get out, is there?
There is, but I think in relation to this book, where I looked at was those beautiful Dutch interiors by Vermeer, and you know that became the ideal in my imagination. So, you take something domestic, something seemingly mundane, a woman reading a letter, a woman working in a kitchen, but you somehow, if you get it right, you find the stillness, the mystery of that. And then if you can just find the right words, you find the words that illuminate, just momentarily, ephemerally illuminate that life.
I suspect you're not a one draft writer.
Well, actually, I think you would probably be surprised that as a teacher for 34 years, I didn't have the luxury of drafting and redrafting. So it's more or less first go. More or less first go.
Fiction Uncovered is a rather novel kind of novel prize in the sense that it has a kind of, as it were, eight winners. I wonder what your response to that is. Obviously, it's very nice to have this, but do you think that's a sensible way to go, to actually look at an ensemble of writing as opposed to, you know, just one sort of champion?
I think it's wonderful, and I'm delighted to be on this list, and it takes that awful cutthroat competitive element out of the event, and I'm happy to share equal billing with the other seven writers, and it's just lovely to have the book receive some attention, so I'm very, very pleased.
The Magnificent Eight, we think of them as. Thank you.
Thank you very much.